This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Can you smell the popcorn? And by the way, don't you wish you could always be smelling popcorn?
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy.
Okay, my favorite food is in the air because Independent Film Festival Boston is back in person. Screenings started April 27th and go through Wednesday, May 4th. So we want to know, how's it going with this first return to screens and people in a studio eating popcorn since 2019? Here with us in the studio, Brian Tam, Executive Director of IFF Boston. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And I do want to note, WBUR is a presenting sponsor of this year's festival. Brian, one day in. How is it going? How excited are you?
So far, so good. Pretty excited. You know, it's great to be back. It's great to see everybody together again. That's what we do. We like to bring people together to share these stories. So it's been super exciting.
So we've talked a lot here on Radio Boston over the last couple of years about what's changed in the pandemic, Brian, including films, movie watching, the film experience. So what's the goal this year in bringing this film festival back together in person? And did it change, like so many other things changed from the pandemic?
I mean, there have been changes. That's absolutely true. I think there are still some people who aren't ready to come back, which is understandable. But I think after spending 2 years sitting on the couch watching movies alone, people really want to come back and be in a community. People want to see movies on the big screen, and they want to feel that experience. When you watch a funny movie with an audience, it's funnier. Scary movies are scarier. And I think people want that experience again, so they're not just, you know, kind of siloed off and they're together.
Do you remember the first movie you saw back in a theater with other people since the start of the pandemic?
Oh, I've seen so many since then. But the, excuse me, the first one I saw was In the Mood for Love when the Coolidge opened back open. That's one of my favorite movies. So I thought that was a nice one to come back with.
And what, how'd it feel?
It's kind of indescribable. I mean, seeing movies in theaters is my favorite thing to do, and kind of being denied of that just felt like I've felt very lost for a long time. And so it gave me, you know, the connection to, you know, the core of what I think about things and how I view the world. So it was really exciting to be back.
Yeah, and I'm asking because we will have listeners today who are like, I don't know if I'm ready to be back in a movie theater yet. And it's interesting to hear somebody who this is your world, you know, what did it mean to you and what did it feel like to you to come back into that space?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's everything, because I really believe in this idea that, you know, film is a machine that generates empathy, and that Roger Ebert says. And I think when you see these movies, you just see other perspectives. And I think, to me, that's the way I broaden my view of the world, seeing how do other people see themselves? How do people tell stories about themselves? And just feeling that connection is so crucial to me. And so it was very hard not to have that for me personally.
So let's stay there for a minute on the films, the curation of this. So I looked this up, and according to a website called Statista or Statista.com, nearly 750 were released in the U.S. and Canada in the last 2 years. And I'm thinking about, okay, you got to pick. So how do you decide? You're curating. The stakes are higher than usual. How do you decide what comes to this festival?
Well, to some degree, we're always, you know, we can only pick from what's out there. So we're just trying to get a sense of what is it, what are the stories filmmakers are trying to tell, and what resonates with us, and what do we think will resonate with our audience? So as we watch, and we watch way more than 750, you know, you just see the movies that you think, you know, I know there's people in Somerville and Cambridge and Boston and Brookline who will really see this movie and really feel it deeply. And so those are the kind of things we're looking for.
And is there anything thematic, either on purpose or by accident, that sort of emerged in your choices?
I mean, I think there's always a lot of accidental themes. You know, we're looking at films, you know, that are submitted to us or that get sent to us from alumni or other festival programmers or that we see at other festivals. And we're not necessarily looking for anything specific, but as they come together, as we start kind of programming them, you do see certain themes come out. You know, I mean, I think there's, you know, the anxiety of what's been happening in the last couple of years is kind of bubbling up, maybe not directly, but indirectly, you know, in the background of things. You know, the way the people feel economic pressures, the way people feel a little bit disconnected, that's showing up. People looking to find their voice, people looking to, you know, use this as an opportunity to, you know, maybe blow up all their life and do something new and do something they really care about. I think those themes are starting to come out in the world.
Starting to kind of echo through what you're seeing in art.
Yeah.
All right, so in a second, I'm going to bring in another voice. But before I do, let's stick with this popcorn theme for a minute and just pop some kernels for us of films people could expect to see, both, you know, fiction, nonfiction.
There's a lot to see. It's kind of hard to pick just a few, but, you know, we have a couple films that, you know, are local. We've got a Girl Talk, which is a documentary by Alicia Small about the girls on the debate team at Newton South High School. That's on Sunday. We've got The House We Lived In, which is coming up on Saturday. I know we're going to talk about that a little bit more later.
Yep, we'll have that later in the show.
We're big fans of local filmmakers, and we want to make sure that we can highlight them and give them the biggest audience we can.
All right, so stay tuned for a second, Brian, because I'm going to bring another voice in now. Ivy Malin is the executive director of the Bradner Film Foundation, Ivy, come on in. Executive director of the Brattle Theater in Harvard Square. And I practiced your name like 10 times before the show started, and I'm just butchering it. It's Moylan.
Moylan, yeah.
Thanks, Ivy. Hi. Sorry about that. Okay, so.
Oh, no worries.
Glad to have you back. And you know, when we first talked about bringing you on to join this conversation today, Ivy, what I was thinking about was talking to you in 2020 as you were thinking about opening your theater back up. And the decisions that you had to make to do that. So I'll ask you that same question. How's it going?
It's going fine, I would say. The joy of having a space that people can gather in again, as Brian was saying, never stops being wonderful. And being able to share films with people is why we do what we do. There's been a lot of ups and downs since we reopened. And, you know, right now we sort of are in a waiting pattern as we wait to see, have we reached a plateau in terms of behavior? Will people start to feel comfortable coming out? Everyone who comes to see a movie at the Brattle that we've experienced is relieved, happy to be there. And I think if they go, they're more comfortable going again. It's just that first visit, is the big hurdle, you know, as we all start to decide whether we do things or not.
So we're talking to do. We're talking with you. You're a leader of this organization. We're talking with Brian. He's the leader of that organization.
Mm-hmm.
But often people who work in an organization all the way down are passionate about what it does, right? So what about all the other team members at the Brattle? What was there a moment where everybody sort of stood still for a second and said, oh, feels so good to be back?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the first day that we reopened, it was like that. And even though, you know, there was still personal anxiety about health and safety and things like that, the counterbalance of the relief. And also, I will say, being in the community that we're in, where our patrons are respectful, they are cautious, they are following the science. So what I've heard of stories in other parts of the country, we're not dealing with. So that was also a relief for our staff. You know, there was a lot of anxiety before we reopened about how hard it was going to be because the news covers the non-compliant people. And it's been the opposite, where our audience is just like, thank you for being open. Thank you for having the protocols in place to make us all feel safe. We're so happy to be back.
So let's bring Brian back in now, Brian Tam of IFF Boston. The two of you now are collaborating in bringing a film festival to Boston, and I have trouble getting my head around the magnitude of that. So, Ivy, starting with you, what does it take? I mean, it's one thing to put films on. It's another thing to be part of a festival. What do you have to gear up on, and what makes you a little bit white-knuckled as this whole thing launches?
So one thing I will say is, in addition to being an executive director at the Brattle, I am also the print trafficker for the festival. So I actually work for the festival to help things get on. So I have very specific answers connected to that. But I don't know if Brian feels the same way, but I feel like for festivals, ramping up and bringing them back, you know, post-lockdown, the big anxiety is, will people come? Are they going to come? Is it going to be the same? You know, we have these memories of full houses and applause and the, just the buzz of the festival experience.
Brian, was that true for you?
I mean, I worry every year if people are going to come. So
he does.
yeah, I mean, it's challenging. I mean, you know, you kind of go into it and you know how it used to work and you have mm-hmm. to be a lot more flexible. You know, we face the same, you know, inflation and supply chain issues everyone else mm-hmm. faces. And so, you know, trying to figure out, okay, well, we used to do this thing and we can't do it for kind of logistical reasons. What do we do? Or we used to do this thing, but I don't know if that works anymore post-COVID, you know, so there's just a lot we need to be just more nimble about, really.
And mm-hmm. and Ivy, is there something you've kept from the COVID era that's a part of how you do things now and you're happy about it?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, on the logistical end of things, I think that something's that's happened in the COVID era is so much more being done online. And not just not viewing, but like purchasing tickets online. Mm. And in terms of film exhibition, there's a lot less media being shipped tangibly and more download links and things like that. And my gut is that's all staying. You know, there's cost savings, there's simplicity, there's just a behavior that changes. You know, you can download a link and then you don't have to worry about it getting lost in transit and things like that. So I do think that those logistical things will continue.
Brian,
for sure.
I'm watching you nod there.
yeah, I mean, that's been a big thing is seeing the movement from kind of people waiting to buy tickets at the festival and people buying tickets earlier. And, you know, I think people are excited to be in person and not watching the films on TV, but they are definitely in that mindset of, you know, we want to be organized and we have mm-hmm. everything at our fingertips and we want the information. I think people are spending a lot more time thinking about our website than they had before, mm-hmm. which is great. We're getting a lot of feedback about that more than we've ever had. So I think people are more cognizant of that, which is great.
So Brian, I want to have a little fun with you and Ivy here. You mentioned as we were preparing for today's show that one of the movies you like, Dos Estaciones, was such a brattle film. So talk a little bit about that. What do you mean by that? Tell us.
I mean, if you go to the brattle lot, I think you know what that means. I don't know if I can totally put it into words, but it's a foreign film. It's a Mexican film. It's about a woman who runs a family-owned tequila factory. And a combination of a blight destroying plants and a big American corporation coming in is putting a lot of pressure on her and, you know, how she deals with that because she's a pillar of her community and how she deals with this pressure on her is the crux of the film. But everyone in it is a non-actor, so it feels like a documentary. And to me, one of the things I love is, you know, what Ned and Ivy at the Brattle do so well is they find these films, often foreign films, by directors who prefer to work with real people rather than actors. And so the line between what's real and what isn't, sometimes people play versions of themselves, that, you know, that kind of disappears. And I think it really immerses you in that film. And I think some of my favorite films that I've seen at the Brattle kind of end up being that kind of film. So when we saw this, Nancy Campbell, our program director, and I said, this has to be the Brattle because this is the kind of film that they champion.
So, Ivy, I'm making the assumption you've seen Dos Estaciones. So
I have not.
Okay.
I will be there on Sunday to see it because I mean, when I read the description, I was like, that's my kind of movie. So
see?
So he's right.
So have you seen any of them? I mean, do you see them like the audience does as they come along, or are you screening some of them in advance? How does that work for you, Ivy?
So I, with the festival, I generally have seen some of the films in advance and then others I'm seeing for the first time with the audience. So it's a nice combination. Last night's opening night film, Emily the Criminal, I saw. I've seen a handful of the other films in the festival, probably like six or seven of them, which is great because it means that there's other movies I can see for the first time.
So I want to go into moments here. I'll start with you, Ivy, and then Brian, I'll go to you. You know, I love movies, even more than I love the popcorn. It's close, but I love movies. And often when I think about a movie that I love, Ivy, it's not the whole film, it's not the whole story, it's moments. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking the other day about the moment in Harold and Maude when Harold tells Maude, I love you, and she says, that's wonderful, Harold, go out and love some more. Is there a movie, a moment in a movie, one of these movies in this Independent Film Festival Boston, that is that moment that you're holding on to, that you're thinking about, that you've played over in your head over and over again among the ones you've seen?
That's a great question. For me, there's a film that's going to play at the Somerville Theater called Every Day in Kaimuki, which is a first feature by a Native Hawaiian. And it's shot, it's a very like American indie. Normally you would see this film shot in New York. And it's really interesting because it's not shot in New York, it's shot in Hawaii. But the scene that really sticks with me from that film is there's a process. He's trying to figure out how to move his cat from Hawaii to New York City. And there's this whole process of like calling, of him being the main character, being on the phone with the airline, constantly having to basically ask the same question over and over again to actually get an answer, that just rang so true to me when you're trying to do something that you almost shouldn't be able to do, mm-hmm. but that is also so simple to do, which is sort of what this film is about.
And what life has felt like in the
that
last couple of years. Brian, how about you?
Well, one that really comes to mind is in a movie called Resurrection, which is playing at the Brattle on Friday. It stars Rebecca Hall as somebody whose life seems very organized and very ordered. But then someone from her past, played by Tim Roth, comes and just upsets everything. And for a long time, we as an audience don't know what's happening. And there's a moment where she explains to another character what's happening. And it's like a 10-minute monologue. And it's so compelling and it's so powerful that I ended up watching it a second time at Sundance because I just couldn't get it out of my head. Mm-hmm.
All right. So I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted by how well Tim Roth plays anything that is upsetting and disrupting.
Agreed.
So,
very fair.
The folks who don't know that you know him probably from Pulp Fiction, if nothing else. All right. So, Brian, last question to you. What's your hope? At the end of this, it's done, and you are full of warmth inside because?
I mean, my hope is always that people come and they feel they're a part of a community and they discover something new. They discover a new storyteller, a new voice. But just that they feel that they had a connection both to these stories and the community around them. That's my hope.
All right. And that is Brian Tam, Executive Director of the Independent Film Festival Boston. Also, Ivy Moylan, Executive Director of the Brattle Film Foundation, which runs the Brattle Theater in Harvard Square. Thank you so much to both of you. I appreciate you joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, imagine waking up in a hospital. You have no idea how you got there. Your family's there. You recognize them. They tell you what happened. You fell. You hit your head. You were in a coma. You just woke up. The thing is, you don't remember it, any of it. And while you know the people around you as your family, you can't remember about 2 decades of your life with them, the kids' birthday parties, the house you called home, even how to play your favorite pastime. That was the experience of Todd O'Donnell of Tewksbury. A decade later, his healing from a mysterious fall that caused a traumatic brain injury is the subject of a new film produced and directed by his son, Tim, of Amesbury. Here's a bit from Todd describing what it's like to live in a world with his injury and without some of his memories.
It doesn't bother me that I don't remember it. It's like I'm sitting on the sideline at a big parade and all of the extrasensory things are going by and I just sit there and just stare and understand that something different is happening.
That's from the film, The House We Lived In, which explores a decade of Todd's life following his 2011 injury. And it's a movie about both memory and mourning. It's set to premiere this weekend at the Independent Film Festival Boston, and we spoke with Todd and his son Tim yesterday about the film, and this mourning and acceptance. And I started by asking Todd if he's seen the film and if he recognizes himself in it.
I have watched it from beginning to end, and I think that 70 or 75% is me, and 25% or thereabouts is somebody else. I remember quite a bit about what transpired, not during the accident, but when I was on the operating table. So when I woke up, obviously, I was in a coma for 9 days or whatever, and I didn't know anything. And when I came to, I recognized the people around the room, my family and my wife. But when I looked at myself, I didn't recognize me because, you know, my head, I felt a little like Frankenstein. But I'm okay. I live in my own world.
So, Tim, you know, Todd's sitting right there. He's saying, not all of that is even me. How now are you dealing with the fact that this man, Todd, is a man you love, but he's not that man you loved before?
Hearing your dad say that 25% of him isn't him, he doesn't know what it is a scary thing, but it's also a beautiful thing. Since the brain injury, I've seen and gotten to experience so many parts of my dad that I don't think I really appreciated or experienced. There's something what happens with folks who have brain injuries where sometimes they lose their filter. So I've seen my dad go through crying spells, laughing spells. All these emotions are out. You know, there's no more, let's not talk about this. Let's keep this private. What happens is you got to deal with it and you get close and you go through it together. I would never want anybody to have a brain injury, but I'm so lucky and I'm so happy that I have this new version of my dad to get to know.
So there are parts of your dad who, because of the loss of memories, aren't the same. But there's also a part of your dad that you have access to now that you never did before.
When Todd is talking about 25% of him not being him, it's a personality thing. It's a memory thing. What happens to us when we lose these big chunks of memory? What happens to our identity? What does that mean about us? These are all things that eventually are going to happen to us. As we age, memory is going to become an issue for everyone. So, you know, this chance to really think about identity, think about maybe the silver lining of things. The new part of my dad is beautiful.
Todd, how does it make you feel to hear Tim say that about you? Talk about the beauty of who you are now after an injury.
Well, I knew that when I came back down to Earth, the way I can think about it is I used to say it was hospital beds that I saw, but it was really clouds, and people were on the clouds, and you got a thumbs up, and you were okay to go to heaven, and those with the thumbs down had to go back because they had to do something else, and I feel that my trip back down is my time to help people, and since I've been back down here, we've interacted with agencies and homes that have brain-injured people, and the brain-injured people are brain-injured, but the caregivers are devastated.
Todd, did you choose to come back down, or do you think you were sent back down?
That's a good question. I think that I came back down because maybe there was a little bit more of me that had a life to live.
What's the unfinished business?
Unfinished business, in my mind, is trying to help people. I'm a firm believer that everybody's story could maybe help somebody. And my story is my story until you see the movie, and then it's your story, because everybody has an opportunity to try to do better. And moving forward, you just have to try the best you can. You can't go back. It's like you're cooking on the grill. You can't go back once it's well done. You can't go back to medium rare. So the way I look at it is I've got to take this opportunity to move forward, to help people, help my family and my wife, and just be in my world.
You said a second ago, Todd, that once your story was in the movie, it was my story. And I'm going to be vulnerable with the two of you for a minute. Especially you, Tim, I was really jealous in watching this movie. So I lost my mom, who I was very close to frontotemporal dementia. And in the early stages of the dementia, she just had a personality change. She just became a different person. And over then a couple more years, we lost her. So you got the change, and then you got a new dad, right? Some of your old dad and some of this new man who you think is beautiful too. And I was really jealous for that. And I wonder how you think about this new chapter and the gift in it and what you wanted to bring across in your storytelling with that.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that story. And, you know, brain injury is a weird thing. You know, me and my siblings would take my dad to support groups. And at these support groups, you'd meet people who have been brain injured for 20 years, 30 years. And you hear that, oh, at year five, this happened. At year 10, this happened. It's pretty incredible what can happen to an injured brain with time. It's double-edged sword. So it's a beautiful thing. We're so lucky. But if you continue that thing by saying, oh, I'm so lucky, I'm so lucky, I'm so lucky, and you don't deal with some of the grieving of the loss, because we all lost a part of my dad. We're so lucky because I'm looking at him right now. He's sitting next to me and I really feel grateful. But I also lost my dad. I lost part of my dad. I lost something. He doesn't remember me growing up. Like, that's not coming back. Maybe it will. Who knows? But like, I think making a film was an added therapeutic element, but also added looking at footage again and again and again. And there is trauma within that. And you got to be able to say, okay, what am I doing to take care of myself?
So what'd you do? What'd you do to take care of yourself?
We've been working on this film for 10 and a half years. I filmed when my dad was in a coma, when he started learning how to walk again. All the things you got to do, you got to relearn everything. I filmed during all this time and it added up and I was getting ready to become a new dad for the first time. Right around the time we were getting ready, getting close to due date, I wanted to try to finish the film and I put myself in a tough spot where I started editing 14, 15, 16 hours a day. And it was nothing major, but it was very apparent to my partner, Allison, that I was having mental health problems. And so, you know, I was able to find the right therapist.
And becoming a father yourself in the middle of telling this story about your father.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like this sort of thing where I'm starting this new rotation. My dad doesn't remember me as a kid. There's little things here and there that might come back, but overall, my dad, his memory of particularly the house we lived in for, you know, 20 plus years was when I grew up. So that's missing. So now here I am having a kid trying to, you know, hold on to every piece of life, making this film. It became a little too much.
So Todd, I'm going to play a little sound of you from the movie.
People don't realize that I've accepted myself for what has happened. And that's why I can move forward, because I've accepted it. If you do not accept what has happened, how can you move forward? Because you're always feeling bad for yourself. I don't feel bad at all. I feel bad for the people around me, like you and mother and stuff like that, but I don't feel bad for myself.
So I actually want to emphasize there the I feel bad for people like you, right? You're in the hospital in that moment and you're talking, I think, to you, Tim, in that moment. Todd, there's this interesting combination in the story about you in this film where you're very clear that you're devoid of emotion a lot of the time, that you don't feel like you'll see old family footage. There's joy in the family footage. You can see it, but you don't connect to it in a way that you can feel. But there's also a really compassionate guy that comes out. You really recognize the pain that your family is experiencing. So at a very simple level, do you feel a lot now? And what do you do with that compassion?
Do I feel a lot now? Well, not really. I know that I'm in a special world, and I know that they can't feel my world, but they're all trying to help me. And I think that now I've more or less plateaued and gone into that world. It's been almost 11 years, but I do know that through the brain injury, because I've got pieces of my past that are non-existent, even though they were pieces of my past. I was never a real bad guy, but, you know, we all dance on the street on the different sides and stuff like that. And you know what? This is just an opportunity for me to go forth and help other people and to tell my story.
All right. So last question, Tim. You've talked a couple of times about the old dad and the new dad. Now you're a dad. One thing from the old dad you want to bring as a dad yourself, and one thing from the new dad you want to bring as a dad yourself.
Something about my dad early on that I noticed was whenever we were walking around in public, let's say we had a wrestling tournament. We're in a major city and walking around. And he would always find somebody that needed something. And whether it's a couple bucks or just a conversation or a slice of gum, that's something that I'm finding myself wanting to do, not to be like, hey, look how awesome I am. It's more like, I hope my kids see that no matter who you are, you can go and have a conversation, you know, and just that sometimes that conversation is a complete lifesaver. The new version of my dad that I really love is what everyone is experiencing right now. There's a openness and a vulnerability that doesn't usually come with age. You know, as people get older, sometimes, and myself included, we become a little bit boxed off on what we want to present, what we want to show. And I think Todd is a constant reminder to be open and to accept what has changed, to accept what is different, and that it's okay. And that is something I will spend a long time trying to learn. It is not something that you can just pick up, but I'm very lucky that I'm in the presence. My dad has that very amazing ability.
That was Tim O'Donnell and his father, Todd. Tim's the director of a new documentary called The House We Lived In, which explores a decade of Todd's life following a traumatic brain injury in 2011. The film premieres at the Independent Film Festival Boston this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Somerville Theater. Now, before we go, I want to ask you to help us out. Shifting gears here, do you have student debt? We're working on a story. If you do, is it holding you back? What would it mean for you if you didn't have it? We want to hear your stories. We want to know your experience. So, to start, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That'll help you connect with us and then tell us your story. Either text it or record a voice memo and send it in. We want to know what's your experience. Okay, coming up, we will do highlights of another film from the festival. Two little boys, ages 9 and 11, they go to the World's Fair in Montreal on the back of a pony cart alone in 1967.
The largest World's Fair ever, Expo 67, the International Twin Island Wonderland, is ready for its gala opening ceremonies.
In the summer of 1967, two little boys, Jeff and Tony Whittemore, wanted nothing more than to go to the World's Fair, Expo 67. But the fair was in Montreal, and Jeff and Tony were ages 9 and 11. They lived in Needham, Massachusetts, and the family did not have money to make that trip. But the boys devised a plan to drive their Shetland pony, King, more than 300 miles alone, and they did it. Their 27-day journey is documented in a new film, Pony Boys, showing this weekend at the Independent Film Festival Boston. Eric Stange is with us, director of the film, and Jeff Whittemore, one of the two brothers who went on the trip at 9 years old. Jeff now lives in Arlington. Eric, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Jeff, great to have you too.
Well, thank you very much.
It's great to have both of you. Oh. Jeff, I'm going to start with you because I want to zero in for a little bit. I think people can't imagine this. When I read about this story and I heard about the pony cart, I thought wagon, right?
Right.
It's this itty bitty thing. So I want you to bring this home. Describe this pony cart for people.
Okay. Well, the pony cart, it's two wheels. It's kind of like a sulky, had a bench. The bench would fit three people. So Tony and I, we fit fine on it. My mother spent a lot of time, rearranging it so that we could fit a tent on it. We had a basket under the seat where we could keep our clothes. And, we also had a spare tire on the bottom, which is not normal for a sulky or a cart.
Okay, but the basket was like a little bucket, and I remember Tony saying, you guys basically didn't change your clothes for 27 days, right? You basically just wore the same stuff on this whole trip, right?
Well, you know, to be honest, it's, you know, that was so long ago. In the film, it was me who said that I didn't remember how we washed our clothes. How mm-hmm. did we, I don't know whether the people we stayed with washed our clothes. For all I remember, we wore the same clothes every day. My guess is we really didn't, but yeah. It is a funny aspect to think about.
All right, so we're going to back up in a minute and bring Eric in, but I want to stay in this tight little space for a minute longer because now we have this little Shetland pony, King. Tell us, not some big horse and no hay on the wagon to take with you. Tell us a little bit about King so people can picture this.
So you want Eric or me to tell him?
So, Jeff, you do that, and then I'm going to bring Eric in.
Oh, okay, yes. Well, King is a Shetland pony, a silver-dappled Shetland pony, one of the nicest animals you can imagine. He was our pet. He was just the sweetest animal. Size-wise, he would probably come up to my waist. So very small. That was our pony King.
Patient, tiny, and young, right?
Well, he was 10 years old at the time.
Wow, he was older than I thought.
Yeah, he was...
All right, so let's bring Eric in now. So Eric, I mean, this is remarkable. Every time I give the little summary, I kind of can't believe it. How did you first hear about Jeff and Tony's journey?
Well, I have to say, I had exactly that same reaction. I heard about it at a neighborhood party, Jeff and our neighbors in Arlington. And I think it was Jeff's wife, Robin, who first mentioned it to me. And I had that reaction, you know, what do you mean, alone? They must not have been alone and in a pony cart. And of course, I pictured something with four wheels too. And as I learned more about it, I realized that it was just such an amazing story. And I kept telling Jeff this. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I've done a lot of films over the years, but I was busy for a long time. But I kept telling Jeff, one day I'm going to come and do this film with you. And I'm not sure Jeff actually believed me, but we finally got it done.
So the finally, was this another moment where the pandemic created opportunity, Eric?
Exactly. It's so funny. We did the first interview with Jeff in my living room. I think about a week before everything shut down. And it turned out to be a perfect project for the pandemic. Jeff was very nearby if I needed to borrow something or the scrapbook or newspaper articles. And I didn't get a chance to interview Tony till much later because of the pandemic. But I could still work on the film. And it was slow going, but everything was slow during the pandemic. And it was awfully nice to have something to fill the days. It was a great project. So cheerful.
So, Jeff, I want to hit the part that everybody's having trouble getting their mind around and probably always have had a little trouble getting their mind around. So this is a little, this is Wendy, your sister, who wasn't on the trip, talking about your mom.
My mother always thought a little bit outside the box, as they say. Learning by doing was really important for her. My father, although there was, I think, some disapproval there, he tried to withhold judgment as far as allowing some things that he might have been a little fearful about, like this trip.
Jeff, when you look back now, can you believe they let you go?
Knowing my mother as well as I do, yes. I do believe they let me go, let us go. I was pretty sure that my father was probably not 100% on board, but my mother did a wonderful job of preparing us, getting us ready for the trip. And I think, you know, to my father's credit, he let us go and did not stop it.
I was really taken by the hardcore life skills that you and Tony were developing during, and I couldn't tell from the film whether it was weeks or months that you were preparing for this July trip, but you learned a lot of really practical, like, life skills and, honestly, animal husbandry stuff during that time. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, that's true, and it was a few months, and we learned... how to care for King. We learned what his needs were. And we, of course, learned how to harness the pony, the cart. And, you know, King needed to be watered. He needed to be watered so many times. We had to make sure of that. And it's actually, you know, to be honest, it's amazing. My mother had the confidence in us going forward to do that, to take good care of King. And but we did. We loved King. King was just, he was just such a great pet. That's how it, we did learn a lot.
He made me think a little bit of Nana from the Peter Pan stories, Jeff. I don't know if you know those stories, but the dog who was sort of a nanny for the kids and had this caretaker role.
Okay, yes. Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. And in a way, you know, King was watching out for us as well.
Yeah. All right. So I want to come back to you, Eric, now. I'm going to play a little. So, okay, let me backtrack for listeners. One of the things that's remarkable in U-Trek, you have physical pictures of the press stories. You really follow the fact that the world, all right, well, the region fell in love with these boys and followed them along their journey. Towns would come out and meet them at the edge of the town. A Boston Globe reporter was following them almost from the beginning. And so people knew about this. And here is Wendy, the sister again, talking a little more about those responses.
There were letters that said, "You guys are fantastic. Here's a dollar to help." And there were a number of people who sent a dollar or $2. It was very sweet. But then there were letters that were very negative. People who said that my brothers should be removed from the home and my parents should be arrested and thrown in jail.
Eric, did you, I'm just going to ask you the hard question. Did you have judgment here as you were, did you feel judgy or not judgy about this as you were making this documentary? And how did you decide to approach that piece?
Well, I never felt judgy about it. I my mother was a bit like Tony and Jeff's mother. I'm not sure she would have let me go that far, but she was all for learning by doing and having adventures. And I saw it more as an adventure story. And it was interesting because in the film, of course, we can only sample a few of the letters, but I read dozens and dozens of them. And a lot of them were very positive too, saying your boys will gain immeasurably from this. It will equip them for life. It will give them tools and skills that they can never get otherwise. And so I think there was a real split in the public. And some people just thought it was out and out child abuse. Obviously I knew it turned out okay. if something terrible had happened, you can imagine just what the press would have been. But I think the fact that it worked and there was never any trouble, any problem, and even in the end, Governor Volpe of Massachusetts, governor at the time, wrote a congratulatory note to the boys that was published in the Boston Globe. So it had the official imprimatur of success and some kind of favorability. You know, it's like a Huck Finn story. It's these two boys on their own finding their way through the world. And I think people do respond to that.
So, Jeff, I want to play a little bit of sound from the movie where you and Tony and then you talk about this brother relationship, how you entertained yourselves, how you kept occupied for 27 days. Here we go.
You know, it was pre-Walkman or cell phone or anything, so we didn't have any portable entertainment with us. We were our own entertainment.
I know there was a song that we would sing, which was Up, Up, and Away by the Fifth Dimension.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful room?
Do you still know all the words to the song?
I don't, but it's, you know what? I still have it on my playlist.
How often do you listen to it?
You know, I listened to it yesterday.
So are you and Tony all these years later, are you close? And if you are, did this affect that? And if you're not, does that surprise you, given the journey that you and Tony went on?
Well, we're close. We don't live next to each other, but we don't know. We're very close. And I think we've always have been ever since the journey. And during the journey, I don't remember that we ever fought or ever had words. We would always, really think that that's what we would do. We would sing, we would tell each other jokes, we'd comment about things we saw along the way. It was just a great trip. It was great fun, and we enjoyed each other very much.
And you made it there, and you were welcomed as VIPs, and you went to the World's Fair.
Yeah, that's right. We were. We made it there. We were VIPs and enjoyed the fair.
Did it live up to the expectations after a 27-day journey to get there?
Well, I was 9 years old. I was expecting Disney World kind of rides, Space Mountain, and there wasn't that. There were exhibits, which were wonderful, but I was 9 years old, and I had just I had just come off one of the best journeys a 9-year-old could ever have.
Eric, briefly, in a sentence, will you ever have a story like this to tell again?
Well, I would hope so, but I doubt it. This is one of those things that just falls in your lap, and as a filmmaker, you just kind of thank God that it happened. You know, it's hard to find stories like this, so I was very lucky.
And what does it feel like? You were very concise, actually, so I have a little more time with you.
Okay.
So what did it feel like when you were done? Did you close a chapter? Were you sad not to spend time with this family anymore?
Yeah, a little bit sad, I have to say. And the other people worked on it, our editor, Rachel Clark. I mean, she would laugh every day. She would laugh as we worked on this film because it just made her so happy. And none of us are going to have an experience quite like that again in the editing room for a while, I'm sure.
All right. So that is Eric Stange, documentary filmmaker, out with the project Pony Boy. The film is showing this weekend at the Somerville Theater. Also, Jeff Whittemore, one of the Pony Boys himself. Eric, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana. Thank you.
Yes.
All right, folks, as we wrap the show with the fifth dimension, I want to make sure you heard the news. Starting May 9th, Radio Boston, we're going to air live at 11 a.m. But don't worry, if you're a 3 o'clock listener, you can catch us then too. We can't wait to be part of your morning. And listen, we really want you to join our texting community to give us feedback on the show, ask questions of our guests, tell us your stories, tell us your story ideas. Join us in this texting community. To get started, you can go to radioboston.org/about to sign up. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us. How about you do it again tomorrow? Oh, actually, we won't be on air tomorrow because we're finishing up getting ready for the move. You'll have fresh air tomorrow, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.